Hey, it's your boy JC.
And Dr. Capel.
And this is the Dream 10X podcast, episode 86. And this week we're talking about the book, The Return of Depression Economics by Dr. Paul Krugman. He is an MIT professor of economics, and this book was written in 1999. Mm-hmm. And I picked it up off the shelf because I was kind of interested in what causes, the booms and bust cycles of economies around the world.
Mm.
And because the bust cycles are really a pain in the butt for everybody, right?
Yes, they like, are.
It's, even, from top to bottom, it's a real pain in the butt. And it's just, why do we have to do this? Why do we have to go through this? I had a professor in college who talked about that. I think it was called, he called it Kondratiev cycles, which are like these 10-year cycles that, these mystical 10-year cycles that, political, economic systems go through. I didn't really understand them, but, and what causes them. And I think there's, what actually causes these boom bust cycles is probably something that people are still studying to this day, trying to understand better, trying to understand how to mitigate those problems. But it just seems stupid, to me. Like, why do we have to go through these boom and bust cycles? And I think probably the reason behind the reason, there are many reasons behind why we go through these boom bust cycles. Things change all the time. Mm-hmm. We get new leaders, they have new ideas. there's struggle for power between people or entities or whatever. And all of these types of conflicts cause changes in the system, which, ultimately results in a boom or a bust cycle. It seems like very rarely is, at least from American perspective, that the economy is just like going, it's the same,
Yeah.
We always have to be growing, infinite growth. And when you're shooting for infinite growth, you're inevitably going to fall, I think. So I don't know, but anyway, I picked up this book. I was interested in maybe picking up a few things. And so here are my top five takeaways from this book. First of all, it takes place, so it came out in 1999. Okay. And the context is, the mid 90s to 1999 with, the fall of the former Soviet Union. They are no longer like the big powerful Soviet Union anymore. They are now Russia. And you've got the Balkan states kind of that have been split out. Ukraine was one of those. And the advent of this new world order kind of idea, being that, okay, now America is the only power on the planet, and let's try, as an American powerful influence, let's try to create sustained growth around the globe and kind of raise the economic ships all around the world. And so one thing, interestingly enough, that was instituted in order to help improve the economies around the world was the reduction of tariffs.
Huh.
When we reduce tariffs, now third world countries can have a chance of getting their goods and services into the markets of first world and second world economies, which helps their economy. Now they're no longer in abject poverty, they're in sweatshops. Yay!
Yeah.
Wow. One step up, from where they were. So that's kind of the context of where we were in the mid-90s. There were a lot of, so in this new world order that was springing forth around the globe, there were a lot of growing pains going on, especially in Mexico. Mexico was having a lot of growing pains. They were struggling in their economy. Asia was having a lot growing pains as well. So there's a lot of economic destabilization around the world, especially in Brazil. Also, we talked about Japan. Which is interesting because I started my career in the 90s, around 94-ish, and it was a very, very difficult time then in the United States for someone just getting out of college to find a job. Military was drawn down. Jobs were really scarce. It was a really, really, really tough time. But from like 94 to 99, like the U.S. economy just took off. Mm. And 98, 99 was a really fun, and probably the most fun I've ever had in my career was those 2 years.
Really?
Even so far. Yeah. It was just a great time. You know, it was the internet. The internet was taking off and there were all those Wild West, you know, companies getting started and venture capital was just going crazy and everything was hot and it was just a lot of fun. And so to read this about all the problems going on around the world, the rest of the world, I was kind of like, oh, wow, there was much angst happening in the world that I wasn't aware of. Mm. And so the larger economic picture, global economic picture, was not that great as it was here in America during that time. And in fact, when we hit the 2000s, everything collapsed in America as well. And that's when the internet bubble burst. And come to find out, now that I read this, the rest of the world was struggling before that even happened. So it was a global contagion that I think we were kind of partitioned off from, maybe because of the whole internet boom.
And then it hit us a little bit later.
And then it hit us in 2000. And so we were already big time economically then. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, our personal financial struggles then, because it was a really tough time. And then, of course, 9/11 happened in 2001, and then that was it. Like, we had a good reason to be hurting at that time.
Yeah.
And then all these world wars, you know, the wars that resulted from that took place. And then again, 2008. So we're going through, 2008 was another time when the bottom dropped out of the market.
Yeah, yeah.
So again, these cycles that just are so devastating and painful for everybody, they just seem so unnecessary. And maybe the hubris of unmitigated growth has something to do with those bust cycles. I'm not really sure, but anyway, okay. So that's kind of the context of the book. That was kind of my first takeaway. The second takeaway was what was the purpose of this book? And it starts with looking at the 1929 stock crash in America and the Great Depression, and how we don't ever want to go through that kind of pain again.
Okay.
So even 2000 was bad. 2008 was really bad. 13, 14. It still wasn't Great Depression bad. Yeah. We weren't standing at soup and bread lines, and I guess something like 30 or 40% unemployment or something like that was not the case. So it wasn't quite that bad. So some of the things that happened post Great Depression was the creation of the Federal Reserve. Mm. And so one of the main primary function of the Federal Reserve is to help prevent that kind of crash in the market again by controlling the flow of money. And so that's one of the reasons the Federal Reserve exists, is to keep an eye on GDP and inflation, and to control the flow of money accordingly in order to prevent crashes like that from happening again.
So is the Federal Reserve part of the federal government, or are they independent?
It's a quasi-federal agency, kind of like Freddie Mac and Ginnie Mae, those guys.
Okay.
They're not truly...
So it's not like an NGO, it's like an NGO then?
I'm not really sure if you would characterize it as an NGO or not. Non-governmental organization. Yeah. I don't know. To be honest, I have to look that up. We should have our admin assistant do some googling.
Piper.
We don't have an
admin. Use your thumbs.
Another thing I pulled out of the book is the concept or the term Tomkin facade. So in 1700s, Russia, Catherine the Great had this guy. She was touring southern Russia, and she had this guy Grigory Tomkin who would ride ahead a day of her on her route, and set up these fake facades in villages to make the poverty-stricken villages look like they were wealthy.
Wow!
And so, because didn't want the queen or Catherine the Great to know that her country was in bad state of economic disrepair than it actually was.
Done something about it.
Maybe, yeah. So we got to hide all that from our rulers so they don't know the true situation, right?
Wow.
And so that term became the Tomkin facade. And so that was just interesting to pull out.
That is interesting. And often does that happen in the workplace? Like, it's like, oh, yeah, that project is coming right along. I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm really behind.
Yeah.
How often does that happen?
The Tompkin facade.
Yep.
Okay, another thing I pulled out was the concept of liquidity trap. So, poor Japan. Japan's got some of the hardest workers in the world, some of the smartest, most educated workers in the world. And their economy was screaming for a while. At post-World War II, they just took off. And we were importing everything. Everything was Japan was exporting to us was great, from cars to electronics, and it still is. It's still one of the best. And their economy was doing great, but then somehow they got themselves into trouble, economic trouble. The economy was struggling, and they weren't doing well, and they couldn't figure out how to get themselves out of it. And so it was like, at the time this book was written, it was like this 8-year-long recession. Even though they were outproducing everybody, outworking everybody, their economy was hot, or their production was hot, the economy was flat. And part of the reason was the Japanese were super savers. They all saved their money. And then they didn't trust how things were going.
Oh, okay.
So they held on to the money and they didn't spend it. And so they got Japan into a liquidity trap. Mm. And one of the interesting things in the book that Krugman does is he creates a mental model, a mental experiment of a babysitting service, ostensibly in Capitol Hill. It's a co-op where people on Capitol Hill agree to this babysitting service, and they all get a fixed set of coupons for babysitting coupons. So if you have a coupon, then somebody in the co-op, you can exchange the coupon for babysitting service. Over time, however, there's a difference between people who want to go out a lot and people that want to save their coupons for a rainy day, mm-hmm. and use their coupons later. And ultimately what results is that nobody can go out anymore because they can't get any babysitting service because some of the people are holding on to all the coupons. And so that's kind of what he states happened to Japan, that they were holding on to the money, they weren't spending it. And so the Maynard Keynes was an economist in the 1930s who said that one way to get out of this type of trap is because that's private money spending. He proposed that the public sector spend money to help get out of this liquidity trap. And in fact, Japan did do that. They did spend public government money to do things, but they didn't get the value out of that spending either. So it's like they were following all of the Western specified playbook for getting out of a recession, mm-hmm. but they couldn't figure out a way to get out of it. So
interesting.
That is another really, like, there is no one playbook for how to get out of a depression or a recession. There's just concepts. There's just theories. There's just ideas, and it's kind of an art. It seems like it's kind of an art, and it's kind of sad because when you think about the Western world was trying to present a playbook to the rest of the world to help them realize mm-hmm. the kind of wealth that we've realized in our part of the world, and they just struggled and couldn't figure it out, and we couldn't even like tell them exactly how to pull themselves out of the problem.
It's hard.
And so I think a lot of it is cultural. Yeah. There's a lot of cultural differences too that you need to accommodate for because, you know, maybe we don't have the discipline that they have in the Far East in terms of monetary discipline and education and all that. So mm-hmm. there's different ways of... Because microeconomics is very closely intertwined with macroeconomics. So the way we behave at a microeconomic level impacts macroeconomics as well. And so therefore, I think culture is a very important part of it. But I don't know. I'm not an economist. I'm just just throwing stuff out there. That was my final takeaway too. My final takeaway actually is what are some of the things that here in America the government can do to help prevent a depression and or a recession? What are some of the tools that we have? Well, number one, like I was just saying, we can print money. The Fed can print money and put more dollars in circulation, and that can help. And in retrospect, I think most economists agree that the Great Depression could have been avoided if the government would have just printed more money and and not caused all these banks to go insolvent when people tried to get their money out of the banks because of all the panic that was taking place. If they had just like printed money and said, here, give them their money back.
Yeah.
You know, that would have calmed things over and prevented the Great Depression. So that's one key thing. Well, the reason we couldn't do it back then is because our dollar was tied to gold.
Oh, and now it's not.
And now it's not. So now we can just print as much money as we want. But that's a problem because that can also create inflation too, right? Yeah. So there's a lot of give and take there. A lot of people want us to go back to the gold standard. But, you know, being on the gold standard is what caused the Great Depression. So you either... You got to be careful if you can print unlimited money because inflation is just as bad. The second thing that governments can do is they can play with interest rates. Mm. They can raise interest rates and they can lower interest rates. And the reason interest rates are important is because it impacts how much it costs people like us to borrow money to buy a home or buy a car or whatever. So the lower the interest rates are, the cheaper the money is going to be, the more likely there's going to be more exchanging of money and increase the GDP, right?
Makes sense.
And another way that I thought of is that, what is my handwriting there?
David Schwimmer.
No. They can devalue or increase the value of money through currency exchange. So I kept reading about how Thailand, for example, devalued the baht, and that caused a lot of problems when you know, especially when you're borrowing money from external. I don't totally understand exchange rates and the value of money and how you can devalue it and how it impacts what money a country has borrowed. I don't fully understand that. I got to think that through a little bit, but that caused a great amount of problems. Mm-hmm. But it greatly impacts your macroeconomic situation when a government says, okay, our exchange rate, we're gonna manipulate that exchange rate for our currency against all the other currencies in the world.
Yeah.
And some countries make that exchange public.
Okay.
And so that opens up some countries to getting their currency hacked, like George Soros did to Great Britain.
When
I want to call it Ultramarathon, but it's not Ultramarathon Fund. It's Quantum Fund or something like that. The George Soros Quantum Fund, which was established in 1969. Anyway, he became a billionaire by manipulating the British pound.
Mm.
And did a run on that currency somehow. I don't fully understand the mechanics of that. I would love to understand that. But basically shorted the currency.
Dang him.
And made a ton of money. I always thought that was a bad thing, but this book points out that interest rates actually came down in Great Britain as a result of that, and that there was more employment as a result as well. So it didn't bankrupt the country by any means. It pissed off a lot of politicians, and some got fired. So I can understand why that was a bad thing for those guys, but for the average person in Great Britain, it sounded like from this book that it was a good, what his fund did was actually a good thing, and it was actually very good for his fund because they made a lot of money. But okay, so the exchange thing is interesting because China does not have a public exchange, so nobody can manipulate the Chinese currency like that. So that was another little thing that I pulled out.
Huh.
So
that is interesting.
That's Depression era economics and the importance of tariffs and how they can wreak havoc on the world. And I think that's important to think about and reflect upon in light of contemporary events. And I hope we're doing the right thing with raising tariffs on everybody. I don't know. Seems scary.
It's very scary.
And it's definitely hurting us from inside of America right now in terms of our 401ks and stuff. I got to thinking about that too. What, you know, Friday we had like a drop of 2,000 points on the Dow. 2,000 points on the Dow in one day. Like, talk about stability. Where's our stability? This is ridiculous. 2,000 points in one day. Why did that happen? And I was mad, you know.
Yeah.
Actually, when you see your money evaporate in one day like that, it's angering. But we don't know who took the money out. Was it institutional investors? Were they American? Were they foreign investors because they were pissed off about the tariffs and they yanked their money? Who knows?
Yeah.
But when you think about that, if it is foreign investors who are manipulating the market like that by withdrawing large sums of money,
mm-hmm.
that makes me not want to participate in the market anymore. Mm-hmm. So, And then people start to panic. This is what happens. Yeah. So we'll see what happens. I hope it's okay. I hope things are going to turn around for the best here. But I don't know. I don't understand what's going on. So hopefully reading a little bit about economics will help explain some things. I don't know. So that's our episode. Thanks for listening. Over and out. We'll see you next book.